Chapter 79. He opened his coffer. In indescribable disorder, it contained collars, rubber bands, kitchen utensils, badges of different technical schools, even the monogram of the Empress Alexandra Feodorovna and the cross of the Legion of Honor. On everything in his madness, he saw the seal of the Antichrist in the form of two linked triangles. Alexandra Sheila, Serge Enilus et le Protocole. The Tribune Juive, May 14, 1921, page 3. "You see," Solon went on, "I was born in Moscow, and it was in Russia, when I was a youth, that people discovered the secret Jewish documents that said, in so many words, that to control governments it was necessary to work underground. Listen." He picked up a little notebook in which he had copied out some quotations. "Today's cities have metropolitan railroads and underground passages. From these we will blow up all the capitals of the world. Protocols of the Elders of Zion, document number 9. It occurred to me that the collection of spinal columns, the box with the eyes, the skins stretched over armatures, came from some extermination camp. But no, I was dealing with an elderly man nostalgic about the old days of Russian anti-Semitism. "If I follow you, then, there's a conventicle of Jews, some Jews, not all, who are plotting something. But why underground?"
"Well, that's obvious. Any plotter must plot underground, not in the light of day. This has been known from the beginning of time. Dominion over the world means dominion over what lies beneath it, the subterranean currents."
I remembered a question of Allier's in his study, and then the Druidesses in Piedmont who called on telluric currents.
"Why did the Celts dig sanctuaries in the heart of the earth, making tunnels that communicated with a sacred well?"
Solon continued.
"The well goes down into radioactive strata, as everyone knows. How is Glastonbury built? And isn't the island of Avalon where the myth of the Grail originated? And who invented the Grail, if not a Jew?"
"The Grail again, my God. But what Grail? There was only one Grail, my thing, in contact with the radioactive strata of Leah's womb, and perhaps now swimming happily toward the mouth of that well, perhaps now preparing to come out, and here I was among stuffed owls, among 100 dead and one pretending to be alive."
"All Europe's cathedrals are built where the Celts had their menhirs. Why did the Celts set these stones in the ground, considering the effort it cost them?"
"Why did the Egyptians go to so much trouble to erect the pyramids?"
"There you are! Antennas, thermometers, probes, needles, like the ones Chinese doctors use, stuck into the body's nodal points. At the center of the earth is a nucleus of fusion, something similar to the sun, indeed an actual sun around which things revolve, describing different paths. Orbits of telluric currents. The Celts knew where they were and how to control them. And Dante? What about Dante? What was he trying to tell us with the account of his descent into the depths? You understand me, my dear friend?"
I didn't like being his dear friend, but I went on listening to him. Julio, Julia, my Rebus planted like Lucifer at the center of Leah's womb. But he, she, the thing, would be upside down, would be struggling upward, and would somehow emerge. The thing was created to emerge upward from the viscera, and not make its entrance with head bowed in sticky secrecy. Solon by now was lost in a monologue he seemed to repeat from memory.
"You know what the English Lees are. If you fly over England in a plane, you'll see that all the sacred places are joined by straight lines, a grid of lines interwoven across the whole country, still visible because they suggested the lines of later roads."
"The sacred places were connected by roads, and people simply tried to make roads as straight as possible."
"Indeed. Then why do birds migrate along these lines? Why do flying saucers follow them? It's a secret that was lost after the Roman invasion, but there are those who still know it."
"The Jews," I suggested.
"They also dig. The first alchemistic principle is vitriol, visita interiora terrae, rectificando in venis occultum lapidem."
Lapis exilis, my stone that was slowly coming out of exile from the sweet, oblivious, hypnotic exile of Leah's vessel. My stone, beautiful and white, not seeking further depths, but seeking the surface. I wanted to rush home to Leah, to wait with her, hour by hour, for the appearance of the thing, the triumph of the surface regained. Solon's den had the musty smell of tunnels. Tunnels were the origin that had to be abandoned. They were not the destination. And yet I followed Solon, and new malicious ideas for the plan whirled in my head. While I awaited the one truth of this sublunar world, I racked my brain to construct new falsehoods, blind as the animals underground. I stirred. I had to get out of the tunnel. "I must go," I said. "Perhaps you can suggest some books on the subject."
"Ha! Everything they've written about it is false. False as the soul of Judas. What I know I learned from my father."
"A geologist?"
"Oh, no," Salon said, laughing. "No, not at all. My father, nothing to be ashamed of, water under the bridge, worked for the Okhrana, directly under the chief, the legendary Rakhovsky."
Okhrana. Something like the KGB. The Tsarist secret police, wasn't it? And who was Rakhovsky? Wasn't there someone who had a similar name? By God, the colonel's mysterious visitor, Count Rakhovsky. No, enough of this. No more coincidences. I didn't stuff dead animals. I created living animals. Chapter 80. When White arrives in the matter of the great work, life has conquered death, the king is resuscitated, earth and water have become air, it is the domain of the moon, their child is born. Then matter achieves such a degree of fixity that fire can no longer destroy it. When the artist sees perfect whiteness, the philosophers say the books must be torn up, for they are now useless. Dom J. Pernetti, Dictionnaire Mytho-Hermétique, Paris, Bosch, 1758, Blancheur. I mumbled some excuse, in haste. I believe I said, "My girlfriend's having a baby tomorrow." Salon haltingly offered me congratulations, as if not sure who the father was. I ran home to breathe some clean air. Leah wasn't in. On the kitchen table, a piece of paper. "Darling, the waters have broken. Couldn't get you at the office. Taking a taxi to the hospital. Come, I feel alone." A moment of panic. I had to be there to count with Leah. I should have been in the office, reachable. It was my fault. The thing would be born dead. Leah would die with it. Salon would stuff them both. I entered the hospital on unsteady legs, asked directions of people who didn't know anything, twice ended up in the wrong ward. I shouted that they had to know where Leah was having the baby, and they told me to calm down because here everybody was having a baby. Finally, I don't know how, I found myself in a room. Leah was pearly pale but smiling. Someone had lifted her hair and put it under a white cap. For the first time I saw Leah's forehead in all its splendor. Next to her was the thing.
"It's Julio," she said.
My rebus. I, too, had made him, and not with chunks of dead bodies or arsenic soap. He was whole. All his fingers and toes were in the right place. I insisted on seeing all of him, his little cock, his big balls. Then I kissed Leah on her naked brow. "The credit is yours, darling. It all depends on the vessel."
"Of course the credit is mine, you shit. I had to count all by myself."
"For me, you are all that counts," I told her. Chapter 81. The subterranean people have reached the highest knowledge. If our mad humankind should begin a war against them, they would be able to explode the whole surface of our planet. Ferdinand Ossendowski, Beasts, Men and Gods, 1924, Roman 5. I stayed at home with Leah because once she left the hospital and had to change the baby's diapers, she cried and said she would never be able to cope. Somebody explained to us that this was normal. The excitement over the victory of birth is followed by a feeling of helplessness in the face of the immensity of the job. During those days, while I loafed around the house, useless and not qualified, of course, for breastfeeding, I spent long hours reading everything I had been able to find concerning telluric currents. On my return, I sounded out Allier on them. He made a gesture of boredom. "Weak metaphors, referring to the secret of the serpent Kundalini. Chinese geomancy also sought in the earth the traces of the dragon. The telluric serpent simply stands for the occult serpent. The goddess reposes, coiled, and sleeps her eternal sleep. Kundalini throbs gently, binding heavy bodies to lighter bodies, like a vortex or a whirlpool, like the first half of the syllable Om." "But what secret does the serpent refer to?"
"To the telluric currents."
"What are the telluric currents?"
"A great cosmological metaphor which refers to the serpent."
"To hell with Allier," I said to myself. "I know more than that." I read my notes to Belbo and Diotelevi, and we no longer had any doubt. At last we were in a position to supply the Templars with a decent secret. It was the most economical, the most elegant solution to the problem, and all the pieces of our millennial puzzle fit together. So, The Celts knew about telluric currents. They had learned the secret from the Atlantides when the survivors of the submerged continent emigrated, some to Egypt, some to Brittany. The Atlantides had learned it from those ancestors of ours who ventured forth from Avalon across the continent of Mu as far as the central desert of Australia, when all the continents were a single landmass, the wondrous Pangaea. If only we could still read, as the Aborigines can, but they remain silent, the mysterious alphabet carved on the great boulder Ayers Rock, we would have the answer. Ayers Rock is the antipode of the great unknown mountain that is the pole, the true occult pole, not the one that any bourgeois explorer can reach. As usual, and this should be obvious to anyone whose eyes have not been blinded by the false light of Western science, the pole that we see is not the real pole, for the real pole is the one that cannot be seen, except by some adepts whose lips are sealed. The Celts, however, believed it was enough to discover the global configuration of the currents. That's why they erected megaliths. The menhirs had sensitive devices, like electric valves, planted at the points where the currents branched and changed direction. The lees marked the routes of currents already identified. The dolmens were chambers of accumulated energy, where the druids, with geomantic tools, attempted to map, by extrapolation, the global design. The cromlechs and Stonehenge were micro-macrocosmic observatories from which they studied the pattern of the constellations in order to divine the pattern of the currents. Because, as the Tabula Smaragdina tells us, what is above is isomorphic to what is below. But there was more to the problem than that. The other branch of the Atlantidean emigration realized as much. The occult knowledge of the Egyptians passed from Hermes Trismegistus to Moses, who took care not to pass it on to his band of tatterdemalions, their craws still stuffed with manna. To them he offered the Ten Commandments, which was as much as they could comprehend. The higher truth is aristocratic. Moses encoded it in the Pentateuch. The Kabbalists understood this. "Just think," I said, "everything was already written, an open book in the measurements of the Temple of Solomon, and the keepers of the secret were the Rosicrucians, who formed the Great White Fraternity, the Essenes, in other words, who, as is well known, let Jesus in on their secrets. And there you have the real reason why Jesus was crucified." Of course, the Passion of Christ is an allegory prefiguring the trial of the Templars. Right. And Joseph of Arimathea takes, or takes back, the secret of Jesus to the land of the Celts. But obviously the secret is still incomplete. The Christian Druids know only a fragment of it, and that is the esoteric meaning of the Grail. There is something missing, but we don't know what. The secret, what the temple already said in full, is suspected only by a small group of rabbis who remained in Palestine. They entrust it to the occult Muslim sects, to the Sufis, the Ismailis, the Mutakallimun. And from them the Templars learn it. "At last, the Templars! I was beginning to worry," Belbo said. We were shaping the plan, which, like soft clay, obeyed our thumbs, our narrative desires. The Templars had discovered the secret during those sleepless nights, embracing their saddle mates in the desert where the implacable simoom was blowing. They had wrested it bit by bit from those who knew the powers of cosmic focus in the Black Stone of Mecca, the heritage of the Babylonian Magi. For it was clear now that the Tower of Babel had been simply an attempt, however hasty and deservedly a failure because of the pride of its architects, to build the most powerful menhir of all. But the Babylonians got their calculations wrong. As Father Kircher has demonstrated, had the tower reached its peak, its excessive weight would have made the Earth's axis rotate 90 degrees and maybe more, and our poor globe, instead of having an ithyphallic crown pointing upward, would have found itself with a sterile appendix, a limp mentula, a monkey tail flopping downward, a Shekinah lost in the dizzying abyss of an Antarctic Malkut, a flaccid hieroglyph for penguins. So, in a word, what's the secret discovered by the Templars? Don't rush me, we're getting there. It took 7 days to make the world, and now we'll give it a try. Chapter 82. The Earth is a magnetic body. In fact, as some scientists have found, it is one vast magnet, as Paracelsus affirmed some 300 years ago. H. P. Blavatsky, Isis Unveiled, New York, Bolton, 1877, Volume 1, page Roman 23. We gave it a try, and we succeeded. The Earth is a great magnet, and the force and direction of its currents are influenced by the celestial spheres, the cycle of the seasons, the precession of the equinoxes, the cosmic cycles. Thus the pattern of the currents changes. But it must change like hair, which, though it grows everywhere on the top and sides of the skull, nevertheless spirals out from a point toward the back, where it rebels most against the comb. When that point has been identified, when the most powerful station has been established there, it will be possible to control, direct, command all the telluric currents of the planet. The Templars realized that the secret lay not only in possessing the global map of the currents, but also in knowing the critical point, the omphalos, the umbilicus tellurus, the navel of the world, the source of command. All alchemistic talk, the thonic descent of the black work, the electric charge of the white, is only a metaphor clear to the initiated for this age-old auscultation whose final result will be the red. Global knowledge, brilliant dominion over the planetary system of currents. The secret, the real secret of alchemy and Templars, is the search for the wellspring of that internal rhythm, as sweet, awesome, and regular as the throbbing of the serpent Kundalini, still unknown in many of its aspects, yet surely as precise as a clock. For it is the rhythm of the one true stone that fell in exile from heaven, the great Mother Earth. This was what Philip the Fair wanted to know, hence the Inquisitor's sly insistence on the mysterious kiss in posteriori parte spine dorsi. They wanted the secret of Kundalini. Who cares about sodomy?
It's perfect, Diotaledi said. But then, when you know how to direct the telluric currents, what do you do with them? Make beer?
Come on, I said. Haven't you grasped the significance of this discovery?
In the telluric navel, you place the most powerful valve which enables you to foresee rain and drought, to release hurricanes, tidal waves, earthquakes, to split continents, sink islands. No doubt Atlantis disappeared in some such reckless experiment. Raise mountain chains. You realize the atomic bomb is nothing in comparison? Besides which, it also hurts the one who drops it. From your control tower, you telephone, for example, the President of the United States, and you say to him, by tomorrow morning I want a dodecadillion dollars, or the independence of Latin America, or the state of Hawaii, or the destruction of your stockpile of nuclear weapons, or else the San Andreas Fault will crack definitively and Las Vegas will become a floating casino.
But Las Vegas is in Nevada.
Doesn't matter. When you control the telluric currents, you can snip off Nevada too in Colorado. Then you telephone the Supreme Soviet and you say, comrades, by Monday I want all the caviar of the Volga, and I want Siberia as my frozen food locker. Otherwise I'll suck the Urals under, I'll make the Caspian overflow, I'll cut loose Lithuania and Estonia and sink them in the Philippine Trench.
Yes, Diotaledi said, the power would be immense. The earth could be rewritten like the Torah. Japan lands in the Gulf of Panama.
Panic on Wall Street.
Forget about Star Wars. Forget about transforming base metal into gold. You aim the right current, stir up the bowels of the earth, and make them do in 10 seconds what it used to take them billions of years to do, and the whole roar becomes a diamond mine. Eliphas Levi said the knowledge of the universe's tides and currents holds the secret of human omnipotence.
That must be so, Belbo said. It's like transforming the whole world into an orgon box. It's obvious. Reich was definitely a Templar.
Everyone was, except us. Thank God we've caught on. Now we're a step ahead of them.
But what stopped the Templars once they knew the secret? The problem was how to exploit it. Between knowing and know-how, there was a gap. So, instructed by the diabolical Saint Bernard, the Templars replaced the menhirs, poor Celtic valves, with Gothic cathedrals, far more sensitive and powerful. Their subterranean crypts containing black virgins in direct contact with the radioactive strata. And they covered Europe with a network of receiver-transmitter stations communicating to one another the power and the direction, the flow and the tension of the telluric currents. I say they located the silver mines in the New World, caused eruptions of silver there, and then, controlling the Gulf Stream, shifted that precious metal to the Portuguese coast. Tomar was the distribution center, the Foray d'Orion, the chief storehouse. This was the origin of their wealth, but this was peanuts. They realized that to exploit their secret fully, they would have to wait for a technological advance that would take at least 600 years. Thus, the Templars organized the plan in such a way that only their successors, at the moment when they would be able to make proper use of what they knew, would learn the location of the umbilicus tellurus.
But how did the Templars distribute the pieces of the revelation to the 36 scattered throughout the world? How could a straightforward message have that many parts? And why would they need such a complicated message, just to say that the umbilicus was, for example, in Baden-Baden, or Tralee, or Chattanooga? A map? But a map would be marked with an X at the point of the umbilicus. Whoever held the piece with the X would know everything and not need the other pieces. No, it had to be more involved. We racked our brains for several days until Belbo decided to resort to Abulafia, and the reply was, Guillaume Postel dies in 1581, Bacon is Viscount St. Albans, in the Conservatoire is Foucault's pendulum. The time had come to find a function for the pendulum. I was able in a few days to suggest a rather elegant solution. A diabolical had submitted to us a text on the hermetic secret of cathedrals. According to this author, the builders of Chartres one day left a plumb line hanging from the keystone of a vault.
No, Belbo said, the cardinals who condemned Galileo were Templar adepts infiltrating Rome. They wanted to shut up that damned Tuscan quickly, that traitor Templar who in his vanity was about to spill the beans 400 years before the date of the plan's fulfillment. This explained why beneath the pendulum those master masons had drawn a labyrinth, a stylized image of the system of subterranean currents. We sought an illustration of the labyrinth of Chartres, a solar clock, a compass card, a vein system, a sleepy sinusoidal trail of the serpent, a global chart of the telluric tides. All right, let's assume the Templars used the pendulum to indicate the umbilicus. Instead of the labyrinth, which is, after all, an abstract scheme, on the floor you put a map of the world. The point marked by the tip of the pendulum at a given hour is the point that marks the umbilicus. But which pendulum? The place is beyond discussion, Saint-Martin-des-Champs, the refuge. Yes, Belbo replied, but let's suppose that at the stroke of midnight the pendulum swings from Copenhagen to Cape Town. Where is the umbilicus? In Denmark or in South Africa? A good observation, I said. But our diabolical tells us also that in Chartres there is a fissure in a stained-glass window of the choir, and at a given hour of the day a sunbeam enters through the crack and always hits the same place, always the same stone on the floor. I don't remember what conclusion he draws from this, but in any event it's a great secret. So here's the mechanism. In the choir of Saint-Martin, there is a window that has an uncolored spot near the juncture of two lead canes. It was carefully calculated, and probably for 600 years someone has always taken care to keep it as it is. At sunrise on a given day of the year, which can only be the dawn of June 24th, St. John's Day, Feast of the Summer Solstice. Yes, on that day, and at that hour, the first pure ray of sun that comes through the windows strikes the floor beneath the pendulum, and the pendulum's intersection of the ray at that instant is the precise point on the map where the umbilicus is to be found. Perfect, Belbo said. But suppose it's overcast? They wait until the following year. I'm sorry, but Belbo said. The last meeting is to be in Jerusalem. Shouldn't the pendulum be hanging from the top of the dome of the Mosque of Omar? No, I said. At certain places on the globe, the pendulum completes its circle in 36 hours. At the North Pole, it takes 24 hours. At the equator, the cycle doesn't vary with the season. So the location matters. If the Templars made their discovery at Saint-Martin, their calculation is valid only in Paris. In Palestine, the pendulum would mark a different curve. And how do we know they made the discovery at Saint-Martin? The fact that they chose Saint-Martin as their refuge, that from the Prior of St. Albans to Postel to the Convention, they kept it under their control, that after Foucault's first experiments they installed the pendulum there. Too many clues. But still, the last meeting is in Jerusalem. So? In Jerusalem they'll put the message together, and that's not a matter of a few minutes. Then they'll prepare for a year, and the following June 23rd all six groups will meet in Paris, to learn finally where the umbilicus is, and then they'll set to work to conquer the world. But, Belbo insisted, there's still something I can't figure out. Although there's this final revelation about the umbilicus, all 36 must have known that before. The pendulum had been used in cathedrals, so it wasn't a secret. What would have prevented Bacon or Postel or even Foucault, who must have been a Templar himself, seeing all the fuss he made over the pendulum, from just putting a map of the world on the floor and orienting it by the cathedral points? We're off the track. No, we're not off the track, I said. The message reveals something that none of them could know.
what map to use.
Chapter 83. A map is not the territory. Alfred Korsibsky, Science and Sanity, 1933, 4th edition, The International Non-Aristotelian Library, 1958, Volume 2, Number 4, page 58. You're familiar with the situation of cartography at the time of the Templars, I said. In that century, there were Arab maps that, among other things, put Africa at the top and Europe at the bottom. Navigators' maps, fairly accurate, all things considered, and maps that by then were already 300 or 400 years old but were still accepted in some schools. Mind you, to reveal the location of the umbilicus, they didn't need an accurate map in today's sense. It had to be simply a map possessing this virtue. Once oriented, it would show the umbilicus at the point where the arc of the pendulum is struck by the first ray of sun on June 24th. Now listen carefully. Let's suppose, purely as a hypothesis, that the umbilicus is in Jerusalem. Even with our modern maps, the position of Jerusalem depends on the projection used. And God knows what kind of map the Templars had, but it doesn't matter. It's not the pendulum that's calibrated according to the map. It's the map that's calibrated according to the pendulum. You follow me? It could be the craziest map in the world, as long as, when placed beneath the pendulum, at the crack of dawn on the 24th of June, it shows the one and only spot that is Jerusalem. This doesn't solve our problem, Diotalevi said. Of course not, and it doesn't solve it for the Invisible 36 either, because if you don't have the right map, forget it. Let's take the case of a map oriented in the standard way, with east in the direction of the apse and west toward the nave, since that's how churches are built. Now, let's say at random that on that fatal dawn the pendulum is near the boundary of the southeast quadrant. If it were a clock, we'd say that the hour hand is at 5:25. All right? Now look. I went to dig out a history of cartography. Here, Exhibit Number 1, a 12th-century map. It follows the T-structured maps. Asia is at the top with the earthly paradise. To the left, Europe. To the right, Africa. And here, beyond Africa, they've also put the Antipodes. Exhibit Number 2, a map inspired by the Somnium Scipionis of Macrobius, and it survives in various versions into the 16th century. Africa's a bit narrow, but that's all right. Now look. Orient the two maps in the same way, and you see that on the first map, 525 corresponds to Arabia, and on the second map, to New Zealand, since that's where the second map has the Antipodes. You may know everything about the pendulum, but if you don't know what map to use, you're lost. So the message contained instructions, elaborately coded on where to find the right map, which may have been specially drawn for the occasion. The message told where to look, in what manuscript, in what library, abbey, castle. It's even possible that Dee or Bacon or someone else reconstructed the message. Who knows? The message said the map was at X, but in the meantime, with everything that was going on in Europe, the abbey that housed the map burned down, or the map was stolen, hidden God knows where. Maybe somebody has the map but doesn't know the use of it, or knows it's valuable but doesn't know why, and he's going around the world looking for a buyer. Imagine all the confusion of offers, false trails, messages that say other things but are understood to refer to the map, and messages that indeed refer to the map but are read as if hinting at, say, the production of gold. No doubt some people attempt to reconstruct the map purely on the basis of conjectures. What sorts of conjectures? Well, for example, micro-macrocosmic correspondences. Here's another map. You know where it comes from? It appears in the second treatise of the Utriusque Cosmi Historia of Robert Fludd. Fludd is the Rosicrucians man in London, don't forget. Now, what does our man do, our Robertus de Fluctibus, as he liked to style himself? He offers what is no longer a map, but a strange projection of the entire globe from the point of view of the pole, the mystic pole, naturally, and therefore from the point of view of an ideal pendulum suspended from an ideal keystone. This is a map specially conceived to be placed beneath a pendulum. It's obvious, undeniable. I can't imagine why someone hasn't already seen. The fact is, the diabolicals are very, very slow, Belbo said. The fact is, we are the only worthy heirs of the Templars. But to continue, you recognize the design. It's a mobile rotula, like the ones Stratemius used for his coded messages. This isn't a map, then. It's a design for a machine to produce variations of maps until the right map is found. And Fludd says as much in the caption. This is the sketch for an instrumentum. It still needs work. But wasn't Fludd the one who persisted in denying the rotation of the earth? How could he think of the pendulum? We're dealing with initiates. An initiate denies what he knows, denies knowing it to conceal it. This, Belbo said, would explain why Dee paid so much attention to those royal cartographers. It was not to discover the true form of the earth, but to reconstruct, among all the mistaken maps, the one right map, the one of use to him.
Not bad, not bad at all, Dee O'Tolevi said. To arrive at the truth through the painstaking reconstruction of a false text.
Chapter 84. The chief occupation of this assembly, and in my opinion the most useful, should be to work on natural history following the plans of Verulam. Christian Huygens, Letter to Colbert, Oeuvre Complète, La Haye, 1888-1950, Volume 6, pages 95-96. The vicissitudes of the six groups were not confined to the search for the map. In the first two pieces of the message, those in the hands of the Portuguese and the English, the Templars probably referred to a pendulum, but ideas about pendulums were still hazy. It's one thing to swing some lead on a length of cord, and quite another to construct a mechanism precise enough to be hit by a ray of the sun at an exact time and place. This is why the Templars calculated for 6 centuries. The Baconian wing set immediately to work and tried to draw to its side all the initiates whom it made desperate efforts to reach. It is no coincidence that Salomon de Caux, the Rosicrucian's man, writes for Richelieu a treatise on solar clocks. And afterward, from Galileo on, there is furious research devoted to pendulums. The pretext is to figure out how to use them for determining longitudes. But in 1681, when Huygens discovers that a pendulum accurate in Paris is slow in Cayenne, he immediately realizes that this discrepancy is due to the variation in centrifugal force caused by the rotation of the earth. And after he publishes his Orologium Oscillatorium, in which he elaborates on Galileo's intuitions about the pendulum, who summons him to Paris? Colbert, the same man who summons to Paris Salomon de Caux to work on the tunnels beneath the city. In 1661, when the Accademia del Cimento foreshadows the conclusions of Foucault, Leopold of Tuscany dissolves it in the space of 5 years and immediately afterward receives from Rome, as a secret reward, a cardinal's hat. But there is more. In the centuries that follow, the hunt for the pendulum continues. In 1742, a year before the first documented appearance of the Comte de Saint-Germain, a certain Meyrin presents a paper on pendulums at the Académie Royale des Sciences. In 1756, the year that Templar strict observance originates in Germany, a certain Bouguer writes Sur la direction qu'affecte tous les fils à plomb. I found phantasmagorical titles, like that by Jean-Baptiste Biot in 1821. Recueil d'observations géodésiques, astronomiques et physiques, exécuté par ordre du Bureau des longitudes de France, en Espagne, en France, en Angleterre et en Écosse, pour déterminer la variation de la pesanteur et des degrés terrestres sur le prolongement du méridien de Paris. In France, Spain, England, and Scotland, and referring to the meridian of Saint-Martin. And what about Sir Edward Sabin, who in 1823 publishes an account of experiments to determine the figure of the earth by means of the pendulum vibrating seconds in different latitudes? And the mysterious Graf Feodor Petrovich Littke, who in 1836 publishes the results of his research into the behavior of the pendulum in the course of a voyage around the world. This under the auspices of the Imperial Academy of Sciences of St. Petersburg. The Russians, too? And what if in the meantime a group, no doubt of Baconian descent, decides to discover the secret of the currents without map or pendulum, relying instead on the source, the respiration of the serpent? Solon's hunch was right, for it was more or less at the time of Foucault that the industrial world, creature of the Baconian camp, began digging underground systems in the heart of the great cities of Europe. It's true, Belbo said. The 19th century is obsessed with the underground. Jean Valjean, Fantômas and Javert, Rocambole, all that coming and going in sewers and tunnels. My God, now that I think of it, all of Verne is an occult revelation of the mysteries of the underground. The voyage to the center of the earth, 20,000 leagues under the sea, the caverns of the mysterious island, the immense underground realm of the Black Indies. If we drew a diagram of his extraordinary travels, we would be sure to obtain, finally, a sketch of the coils of the serpent, a chart of the leaves drawn for each continent. Verne explores the network of the telluric currents from above and below. I collaborated. What's the name of the hero of the Black Indies? John Garrel? Close to Grail. We're not ivory tower eggheads. We're men with feet on the ground. Verne gives even more explicit signals. Robur le Conquérant, R.C. Rosy Cross. And Robur, read backward, is Rubor, the Red of the Rose. Chapter 85. Phileas Fogg, a name that is also a signature. Eos, in Greek, has the sense of the global. It is therefore the equivalent of Pan, of Poly, and Phileas is the same as polyphile. As for Fogg, it is the English for Bouillard, and no doubt Verne belonged to Le Bouillard. He was even kind enough to indicate the relationship between this society and the Rose and Cross, because what, enfin, is our noble traveler Phileas Fogg if not a Rose and Cross? And further, doesn't he belong to the Reform Club, whose initials, R.C., designate the reforming Rose and Cross? And this Reform Club stands in pell-mell, suggesting once again the dream of polyphile. Michel Lamy, Jules Verne, Initié et Initiateur, Paris, Bayeux, 1984, pages 237 to 238. The reconstruction took us days and days. We would interrupt our work to confide in one another the latest connection. We read everything we could lay our hands on. Encyclopedias, newspapers, cartoon strips, publishers' catalogs, and read it squinting, seeking possible shortcuts. At every bookstall we stopped and rummaged. We sniffed newsstands, stole abundantly from the manuscripts of our diabolicals, rushed triumphantly into the office, slamming the latest find on a desk. As I recall those weeks, everything seems to have taken place at a frenzied pace, as in a Keystone Cops film. All jerks and jumps, with doors opening and closing at supersonic speed, cream pies flying, dashes up flights of steps, up and down, back and forth, old cars crashing, shelves collapsing in grocery stores amid avalanches of cans, bottles, soft cheeses, spurting siphons, exploding flour sacks. Yet the intermissions, the idle moments, the rest of life going on around us, I remember as a story in slow motion, the plan taking gradual shape with the discipline of gymnastics, or like the slow rotation of the discus thrower, the cautious sway of the shot putter, the long tempos of golf, the senseless weights of baseball. But whatever the rhythm was, luck rewarded us, because wanting connections, we found connections, always, everywhere, and between everything. The world exploded into a whirling network of kinships, where everything pointed to everything else, everything explained everything else. I said nothing about it to Leah, to avoid irritating her, and I even neglected Julio. I would wake up in the middle of the night with the realization, for example, that René Descartes could make R.C., and that he had been over-energetic in seeking and then denying having found the Rosicrucians. Why all that obsession with method? Because it was through method that you arrived at the solution to the mystery that was fascinating all the initiates of Europe. And who had celebrated the enchantment of Gothic? René de Chateaubriand. And who, in Bacon's time, wrote Steps to the Temple? Richard Crashaw. And what about Ranieri de Calzabigi? René Char? Raymond Chandler? And Rick of Casablanca. Chapter 86. This science, which was not lost, at least as far as its practice was concerned, was taught to the cathedral builders by the monks of Citeaux. They were known in the last century as Compagnons du Tour de France. It was to them that Eiffel turned to build his tower. L. Charpentier, Les Mystères de la Cathédrale de Chartres, Paris, Lafont, 1966, pages 55 to 56. Now we had the entire modern age filled with industrious moles tunneling through the earth, spying on the planet from below. But there had to be something else, another venture the Baconians had set in motion, whose results, whose stages, were before everyone's eyes, though no one had noticed them. The ground had been punctured and the deep strata tested, but the Celts and the Templars had not confined themselves to digging wells. They had planted their stations and aimed them straight at the heavens, to communicate from megalith to megalith, and to catch the influences of the stars. The idea came to Belbo during a night of insomnia. He leaned out the window and saw in the distance, above the roofs of Milan, the lights of the steel tower of the Italian radio, the great city antenna. A moderate, prudent babble. And he understood. The Eiffel Tower, he said to us the next morning. Why didn't we think of it before? The metal megalith, the menhir of the last Celts, the hollow spire, taller than all Gothic spires. What need did Paris have of this useless monument? It's the celestial probe, the antenna that collects information from every hermetic valve stuck into the planet's crust. The statues of Easter Island, Machu Picchu, the Statue of Liberty, conceived first by the initiate Lafayette, the obelisk of Luxor, the highest tower of Tamar, the Colossus of Rhodes, which still transmits from the depths of a harbor that no one can find, the temples of the Brahmin jungle, the turrets of the Great Wall, the top of Ayers Rock, the spires of Strasbourg, which so delighted the initiate Goethe, the faces of Mount Rushmore, how much the initiate Hitchcock understood, and the TV antenna of the Empire State Building. And tell me to what empire this creation of American initiates refers, if not the empire of Rudolf of Prague. The Eiffel Tower picks up signals from underground and compares them with what comes from the sky. And who is it who gave us the first terrifying movie image of the Tour Eiffel? René Clair in Paris qui dort. René Clair, R.C. The entire history of science had to be reread. Even the space race became comprehensible with those crazy satellites that did nothing but photograph the crust of the globe to localize invisible tensions, submarine tides, currents of warmer air, and speak among themselves, speak to the tower, to Stonehenge. Chapter 87. It is a remarkable coincidence that the 1623 folio, known by the name of Shakespeare, contains exactly 36 plays. W.F.C. Wigston, Francis Bacon vs. Phantom Captain Shakespeare, The Rosicrucian Mask, London, Kegan Paul, 1891, page 353. When we traded the results of our fantasies, it seemed to us, and rightly, that we had proceeded by unwarranted associations, by shortcuts so extraordinary that if anyone had accused us of really believing them, we would have been ashamed. We consoled ourselves with the realization, unspoken now, respecting the etiquette of irony, that we were parodying the logic of our diabolicals. But during the long intervals in which each of us collected evidence to produce at the plenary meetings, and with the clear conscience of those who accumulate material for a medley of burlesques, our brains grew accustomed to connecting, connecting, connecting everything with everything else, until we did it automatically out of habit. I believe that you can reach the point where there is no longer any difference between developing the habit of pretending to believe and developing the habit of believing. It's the old story of spies. They infiltrate the secret service of the enemy, they develop the habit of thinking like the enemy, and if they survive, it's because they've succeeded. And before long, predictably, they go over to the other side because it has become theirs. Or take those who live alone with a dog. They speak to him all day long. First, they try to understand the dog, then they swear the dog understands them. He's shy, he's jealous, he's hypersensitive. Next, they're teasing him, making scenes, until they're sure he's become just like them, human, and they're proud of it. But the fact is that they have become just like him. They have become canine. Perhaps because I was in daily contact with Leah and with the baby, I was, of the three, the least affected by the game. I was convinced I was its master. I felt as if I were again playing the agogo during the rite in Brazil. You stay on the side of those who control the emotions, and not with those who are controlled by them. About Diotalevi, I didn't know then. I know now. He was training himself viscerally to think like a diabolical. As for Belbo, he was identifying at a more conscious level. I was becoming addicted, Diotalevi was becoming corrupted, Belbo was becoming converted. But all of us were slowly losing that intellectual light that allows you always to tell the similar from the identical, the metaphorical from the real. We were losing that mysterious and bright and most beautiful ability to say that Signor A has grown bestial, without thinking for a moment that he now has fur and fangs. The sick man, however, thinking bestial, immediately sees Signore on all fours, barking or grunting. In Diotalevi's case, as we would have realized if we hadn't been so excited ourselves, it began when he returned at the end of the summer. He seemed thinner, but it wasn't that healthy thinness of someone who has spent a few weeks hiking in the mountains. His delicate albino skin now had a yellowish cast. Perhaps we thought, if we noticed at all, that he had spent his vacation poring over rabbinic scrolls. But our minds were on other things. In the days that followed, we were able to account also for the camps opposed to the Baconian. For example, current Masonic studies believe that the Illuminati of Bavaria, who advocated the destruction of nations and the destabilization of the state, inspired not only the anarchism of Bakunin, but also Marxism itself. Puerile. The Illuminati were provocateurs. They were Baconians who had infiltrated the Teutonics. Marx and Engels had something quite different in mind when they began their manifesto of 1848 with the eloquent sentence, "A specter is haunting Europe." Why this Gothic metaphor? The Communist Manifesto is alluding sarcastically to the secret hunt for the plan, which has agitated the continent for centuries. The manifesto suggests an alternative both to the Baconians and to the Neo-Templars. Marx, a Jew, perhaps initially the spokesman for the rabbis of Gerona or Safed, tries to involve the entire chosen people in the search. But then the project possesses him, and he identifies the Shekinah, the exiled people in the kingdom, with the proletariat, and thus, betraying the expectations of those who taught him, he turns all Messianic Judaism on its head. Templars of the world unite. The map to the workers. Splendid. What better historical justification for communism? Yes, Belbo said, but the Baconians also run into trouble along the way. Don't think they don't. Some of them set out for the superhighway of science and end up in a blind alley. At the end of the dynasty, the Einsteins and the Fermis, after hunting for the secret in the heart of the microcosm, stumble upon the wrong invention. Instead of telluric energy, clean, natural, sapiential, they discover atomic energy, technological, unnatural, polluted. Space-time, the error of the West, Diotelevi said. It's the loss of the center. Vaccine and penicillin as caricatures of the elixir of eternal life, I added. Or like that other Templar, Freud, Belbo said, who instead of probing the labyrinths of the physical underground, probed those of the psychic underground, as if everything about them hadn't already been said and better by the alchemists. But you're the one, Diotelevi objected, who is trying to publish the books of Dr. Wagner. For me, psychoanalysis is for neurotics. Yes, and the penis is nothing but a phallic symbol, I concluded. Come, gentlemen, let's not digress, and let's not waste time. We still don't know where to put the Paulicians and the Jerusalemites. But before we were able to answer this question, we came upon another group, one that, not part of the 36 Invisibles, had nevertheless entered the game at quite an early stage, somewhat upsetting its designs, causing confusion. The Jesuits. Chapter 88. The Baron Hunt, Chevalier Ramsay, and numerous others who founded the grades in these rites worked under instructions from the General of the Jesuits. Templarism is Jesuitism. Letter to Madame Blavatsky from Charles Southern, 32nd degree A and PR, 94th degree Memphis, Knight of the Rosy Cross, Knight Kadosh, Mark Mason, 104th England, etc., initiate of the English Brotherhood of the Rosicrucians and other secret societies, January 11, 1877, from Isis Unveiled, 1877, Volume 2, page 390. We had run into them too often from the time of the first Rosicrucian manifestos on. As early as 1620 in Germany, the Rosa Jesuitica appears, reminding us that the symbolism of the rose was Catholic and Marian before it was Rosicrucian, and the hint is made that the two orders are in league, that Rosicrucianism is only a reformulation of the Jesuit mystique for consumption in Reformation Germany. I remembered what Salon had said about Father Kircher's rancorous attack on the Rosicrucians, right in the middle of his discourse on the depths of the terraqueous globe. Father Kircher, I said, is a central character in this story. Why would this man, who so often showed a gift for observation and a taste for experiment, drown these few good ideas in thousands of pages overflowing with incredible hypotheses? He was in correspondence with the best English scientists. Each of his books deals with typical Rosicrucian subjects, ostensibly to contest them, actually to espouse them, offering his own counter-reformation version. In the first edition of the Fama, Herr Haselmeier, condemned to the galleys by the Jesuits because of his reforming ideas, hastens to say that the Rosicrucians are the true Jesuits. Very well. Kircher writes his 30-odd volumes to argue that the Jesuits are the true Rosicrucians. The Jesuits are trying to get their hands on the plan. Kircher wants to study those pendulums himself, and he does, in his own way. He invents a planetary clock that will give the exact time in all the headquarters of the Society of Jesus scattered throughout the world. But how did the Jesuits know of the plan when the Templars let themselves be killed rather than reveal it? Diotelevi asked. It was no good answering that the Jesuits always know everything. We needed a more seductive explanation. We quickly found one. Guillaume Postel again, leafing through the history of the Jesuits by Crétinot Joly, and how we chuckled over that unfortunate name. We learned that in 1554 Postel, in a fit of mystical fervor and thirst for spiritual regeneration, joined Ignatius Loyola in Rome. Ignatius welcomed him with open arms, but Postel was unable to part with his manias, his cabalism, his ecumenicalism, and the Jesuits couldn't accept these things, especially one mania that Postel absolutely refused to abandon, the idea that the king of the world was the king of France. Ignatius may have been a saint, but he was also Spanish. So at last a rupture came about. Postel left the Jesuits, or the Jesuits kicked him out. But since he had been a Jesuit, even if only briefly, he had sworn obedience per inde ac cadaver to Saint Ignatius, and therefore must have revealed to him his mission. "Dear Ignatius," he must have said, "in receiving me you receive also the secret of the Templar plan, whose unworthy representative I am in France, and indeed, while we are all awaiting the third centenary meeting in 1584, we might as well await it ad majorem Dei gloriam." So the Jesuits, thanks to Postel's moment of weakness, come to know the secret of the Templars. This knowledge must be exploited. Saint Ignatius goes to his eternal reward, but his successors remain watchful. They keep an eye on Postel. They want to know whom he will meet in that fateful year 1584. But alas, Postel dies before then. Nor is it any help that, as one of our sources tells us, an unknown Jesuit is present at his deathbed. The Jesuits do not learn who his successor is. "I'm sorry, Casaubon," Belbo said, "but something here doesn't add up. If what you say is true, the Jesuits couldn't know that the meeting failed to come off in 1584. "Don't forget that the Jesuits," Diotelevi remarked, "were men of iron, not easily fooled." "Ah, as for that," Belbo said, "the Jesuit could eat two Templars for breakfast and another two for dinner. They also were disbanded, and more than once, and all the governments of Europe lent a hand, but they're still here." We had to put ourselves in a Jesuit's shoes. What would a Jesuit do if Postel slipped from his grasp? I had an idea immediately, but it was so diabolical that not even our diabolicals, I thought, would swallow it. The Rosicrucians were an invention of the Jesuits. After Postel's death, I argued, the Jesuits, clever as they are, mathematically foresee the confusion of the calendars and decide to take the initiative. They set up this Rosicrucian red herring, calculating exactly what will happen. Among all the fanatics who swallow the bait, someone from one of the genuine groups, caught off guard, will come forward. Imagine the fury of Bacon. "Flood, you idiot, couldn't you have kept your mouth shut?" "But, my lord, they seem to be with us." "Fool, weren't you taught never to trust papists? They should have burned you, not that poor wretch from Nola." "But in that case," Belbo said, "when the Rosicrucians move to France, why do the Jesuits, or those polemicists in their hire, attack the newcomers as heretics possessed by devils?" "Surely you don't expect the Jesuits to work in a straightforward way. What sort of Jesuits would they be then?" We quarreled at length over my proposal, and finally decided, unanimously, that the original hypothesis was better. The Rosicrucians were the bait cast for the French by the Baconians and the Germans, but the Jesuits, as soon as the manifestos appeared, caught on, and they immediately joined in the game to muddy the waters. Obviously, the Jesuits' aim was to prevent the English and German groups from meeting with the French, and to that end, any trick would do, no matter how dirty. Meanwhile, they recorded events, gathered information, and put it all... where? In a bulafia, Belbo joked. But Diotelevi, who had been gathering information himself, said it was no joke. Surely the Jesuits were constructing an immense, tremendously powerful computer that would draw a conclusion from this patiently accumulated age-old brew of truth and falsehood. The Jesuits, Diotelevi said, understood what neither the poor old Templars of Provence nor the Baconian camp had yet realized, namely, that the reconstruction of the map could be accomplished by Ars Combinatoria. In other words, with a method that foreshadowed our modern electronic brains. The Jesuits were the first to invent a bulafia. Father Kircher reread all the treatises on the combinatorial art from Lulus on, and you see what he published in his Ars Magna Sciendi. "It looks like a crochet pattern to me," Belbo said. "No, gentlemen, these are all the possible combinations. Factor analysis, that of the Sefer Yisira. Calculation of permutations, the very essence of the Temura." This was certainly so. It was one thing to conceive Flood's vague project of identifying the map by beginning with a polar projection. It was quite another to figure out how many trials would be required in order to arrive at the correct solution. And again, it was one thing to create an abstract model of all the possible combinations, and another to invent a machine able to carry them out. So both Kircher and his disciple Schott built mechanical devices, mechanisms with perforated cards, computers ante litteram, binary calculators, Kabbalah applied to modern technology, IBM, Jesus Babbage Mundi, Jesum Binarium Magnificamur, AMDG, Ad Majorem Dei Gloriam, not on your life, Ars Magna Digitale Gaudium, IHS, Jesus Hardware and Software.